MK listeners. It's Valley Voices. I'm your host, Marilyn Gleason. Today, we're going to be talking to Auden Schendler about all sorts of things, actually, and his new book, Terrible Beauty. We're talking to Auden on the telephone, and let's just say hello. Auden Schendler has had a long career with the Aspen Skiing Company. He was the environmental affairs director for them for, I believe, about 25 years, recently retired, and we're happy to have you on the phone today. Hi, Auden.
Hi, Marilyn. Good to be here.
Great to have you with me. I guess you're nearby in the valley, but not feeling altogether well, and so we're doing this by phone today, but sort of a short-distance phone call.
Yep.
Well, welcome. When was this book published? I know it's quite new. I got to read it. I really enjoyed it. When did it actually come out in the hardcover?
Yeah, and thank you for reading it. It came out at the very end of 2024, so it's basically a 25 book.
Okay. It's called Terrible Beauty. It's got a very interesting, beautiful cover. It's not your typical hand-wringing over climate change followed by a dubious message of hope, which we seem to get so much. This is a book that's really kind of a how-to drive real change regarding the climate, which is something that's obviously been very elusive. I would also, you know, the writing is really lively. It's funny. It's irreverent. It's very personal. And I would say the big message, or certainly one of the big messages, is that corporations want to shift the blame and responsibility for climate change to individuals, and that is wrong and misguided, and we shouldn't buy into it, that corporations are really to blame and have a much bigger impact than we can doing all the little things that we can. Would you like to talk about that?
Sure. Well, that's a good summary of the book. you know, I wrote this because I've spent my career in the climate change field in business sustainability. And I've read all the climate books. And if you said to me, hey, Auden, I've got another one for you, you got to read it, I'd say, no, please, I don't want to. I don't want to read about doom and gloom. I don't want to read about, you know, tech and science all over again. We've heard it all. And I'm not interested in false hope. And so what I wanted to do was write a realistic book about being a human being, about family, about joy, and about life and community. And I wanted to use that thing, those things we love, as a way to inspire people to work on climate change. And then the ways we work on climate change, and this is getting to your question, those need to be real. They can't be token. They can't be small tweaks around the system. And so my critique of corporate sustainability is that the only problem with the approach is that it has nothing to do with sustainability. Mm-hmm. It's more like business management. If you look at what corporations do, they cut their carbon footprint, they write reports, they set targets, they buy offsets. And if they were 100% successful, you wouldn't remotely be close to solving the climate problem. So I have ideas about what corporations ought to do, but I'm also open to the idea that maybe we shouldn't expect corporations to do anything ethical or socially responsible. They may not be capable of such things.
Okay, well, there's a lot of questions there. I guess I'll start with, why would they not be capable of that kind of thing?
Well, they've never done it. Uh-huh. I mean, they're driven by profit. The history of the corporate sustainability movement is really a history of failure and greenwash. I get asked a lot, well, who are the leaders in this? Well, there really aren't leaders, because, again, the kinds of things business calls sustainability, and business will talk about climate change and say they care, but they're all operational programs that really fit under the category of business management. Mm-hmm. So energy efficiency, profitable renewable energy, and so forth. And business is incredibly powerful. Think about Apple. and the customer base and influence it has. And so one of the questions we asked when I was at Aspen Skiing Company was, what if we cared about climate change? What would be the things that we do that would really matter? And the answer wasn't renewable energy development. It wasn't coal mine methane. It wasn't green buildings. It was we'd wield our power to drive the biggest scale political and social change we could. We'd start a movement. And Apple is an example of a company that could do that, but never has. They talk a huge game on climate. But if you look at what they've done, it's all about the recyclability of the iPhone case, the carbon footprint, or the carbon impact of the company. And the CEO of Apple never says in Washington, hey, folks, we got a problem here with climate. It's affecting our business and our customers and our supply chain, and we need policy on it. And you, other businesses, you should join us on this. And that's not what you see in the world, or you do with extremely limited, exceptional opportunities.
I'm going to read a little paragraph here that's early on in the book. Sustainable business strategies that tweak operations but are voluntary and don't move systems. Measures based more on hope than on effect, like biodegradable packing peanuts. Obviously false solutions presented as real ones, like most carbon offsets and renewable energy certificates. Magical thinking, like the notion that free markets will naturally drive sustainable solutions at a profit. And flagrant lies like plastics recycling, which never actually worked or occurred, though we still diligently, quote, recycle to this day. Each of us has, to some extent, bought into this false narrative that misses the bigger picture and the need to change whole systems, not tweak small dials. And some of the work that people in your position end up doing is essentially busy work, keeping track of things, writing reports, as you mentioned, and not really pulling what I've heard you call in the past the big levers.
Yeah. I mean, what you're getting at is one of the main theses of the book, which is this notion of complicity. And complicity in the environmental movement historically means people saying, well, you use carbon too, you use fossil fuels, so you can't talk. And that is not what I'm talking about. And I have an answer to that accusation that we'll get to later. The complicity I'm talking about is that American environmentalism, and in particular corporate sustainability, has undertaken a form of climate action, sustainability work, environmentalism, whatever you want to call it, that would be exactly what the fossil fuel industry would want powerful entities or mobilized citizens to do. In other words, those things, those actions that make corporations appear to be very green, never get in the way of the fundamental fossil fuel economy. They never threaten the fossil fuel industry, and therefore they'll never do anything on climate. And so the question the book asks is, what are those scary, dangerous, meaningful things that the fossil fuel industry and economy is scared of? And you have to think about that and then do it. And that was the kind of part of my work at Aspen Skiing Company, was saying, let's try some stuff. Let's try to pull as big a lever as we possibly can.
So I wanted to ask you about that, maybe the tension for you, Auden, of working inside of a corporation, the Aspen Skiing Company. You know, as progressive as they are and as committed as they tried to appear to be to the environment, and of course they've got a stake in it too, right? Because when we have a warm, dry winter like this, it doesn't really do their business any good. But there's duplicity in the ski company too. One thing, I mean, I know the whole it always drives me crazy that there's all these plastic bottles of everything in all of the restaurants. I mean, could we eliminate that? But there's bigger things like the private jets that people are flying into town to ski there. Even, ski company has a stake, right, in Sentient Jet, or I don't know exactly what the bargain is, but private jets, rich people, huge houses, international guests. How did that work for you, working inside that environment at the ski company? How did you navigate it?
Yeah, so the argument you're putting forth is a argument that I talk about in my book, and it's essentially this. It's the way the fossil fuel industry gets you to shut up. So here it is. It's to an individual or a corporation. Hey, how's it going, Marilyn? Good. How'd you get here today? I hear you're working on climate change. How'd you get here today? Oh, I drove my SUV. Oh, it runs on gas? Yeah. Did you like that? Yeah, I did. How do you heat your house in the winter? Oh, I use natural gas. Do you like having a warm house? Yeah, it's pretty cool. Do you like cold beer? Yeah. You like hot showers? Yeah. That's all fossil fuels, you know, and obviously our valley's getting cleaner. But you see what I'm doing there. The point is to say you can't talk because you're a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the most pervasive argument used against individuals, but also against corporations. And let me answer it.
Do it.
Citizens and corporations did not ask for the services I just described, which are transportation, refrigeration, home heat, mobility. They didn't ask for that and say, hey, I want all those things, society. Will you provide them in a way that will eventually destroy civilization? We didn't say that. What we said was, hey, I want that stuff provided as cheaply as possible. And coal, oil, and gas did that amazingly for 100 years. And the thing that gets lost in the environmental movement, coal, oil, and gas and fossil fuels were incredibly important to society. They lifted people out of poverty. The people working in the coal mines, like the Carbondale miners who died in the 80s, those were good people. They were helping society. But in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, the science started to become really clear. In fact, by the late 70s, ExxonMobil knew exactly what was going on and predicted the amount of warming we've seen today. This was in 1977, using early computers. They still nailed it perfectly. And so what a functional society would have done at that time would be to say, look, science says we have a problem. We're going to have to work on this. But we're not going to rush because we're not going to disrupt jobs and economies and society. We're going to take 50 years to slowly wean ourselves off fossil fuels, develop solar and wind and geothermal and so forth and efficiency. And we're going to begin this transition. But that's not what happened. What happened is the fossil fuel industry saw this coming and they hid the science. They obfuscated it. They funded disinformation programs so that many people in the Senate today still deny that climate change is even happening. They bought politicians, and that was it. They won. And so when you go to a corporation like Aspen Skiing Company and say, you're a hypocrite because of the private jets, the only thing that the ski resort has to do to not be a hypocrite or a citizen is to be doing everything in their power that the cat or the jet doesn't have to run on a fossil fuel fuel. And I would argue that at least in my tenure, Aspen Skiing Company was doing that. And as an individual, if you're working to change that system, you're not a hypocrite. And so, for example, Aspen Skiing Company lobbied for a climate tax. We pushed state laws that increased renewable energy. So we're saying, no, we didn't sign up for this fossil fuel economy, and we're willing to do the work and pay the price to change it.
So, Auden, what are some of the things that you were able to accomplish by working at the Aspen Skiing Company that you are most proud of or that you feel like had the biggest impact or, you know, maybe were the most revolutionary?
Well, it's appropriate that we're talking at KDNK because most important things we as a community did in the Valley, and by the way, everything that I did was a we. This was coalitions of people, even at Aspen Skiing Company. But one of the great things we've done was change the board of Holy Cross Energy over many years and with great difficulty. Some of your DJs were involved in this. Bob Schultz was very involved in this work. And I just talked to a board member of Holy Cross today. He said they're 85% renewable. That's hard to fathom how difficult and amazing that was. And it's a result of the board, but it's a result of the board hiring amazing people like Brian Hannigan, who's the CEO. It's a result of the staff that are doing, you know, basic line work, but also progressive things. So that's a miracle. And that means if you have an electric house using whatever heat pumps, but even resistance heat, you're almost net zero. And it's going to be 100% by 2030. So that's a major win, but it's also a model for the rest of the country. And actually in Colorado, the work that this community did changing Holy Cross was copied in other communities. And I've had other people in other parts of Colorado say, we followed your valley's work very closely and we're replicating it.
So again, your book is not just another depressing accounting of climate change followed by hollow expressions of hope. Some of the things that you talk about to drive real change are getting politically involved. That could mean what you did with Holy Cross Energy, pressuring corporations, publishing articles, writing letters, and pressuring our representatives too. I guess I'd like to just move back to the Holy Cross example and tell me a little bit more about that story. I mean, it was a great story. How did it start out? What happened? What were the important steps?
Yeah. Well, the reason that that came up in our work at Aspen Skiing Company is that I spent several years doing the things that you're supposed to do to cut your carbon footprint, changing light bulbs, changing HVAC systems, putting in controls, solar panels, and on and on. And after a few years, I said, I'm going to measure it now and see how we're doing. And I did, and our emissions had gone up. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I literally did not know what was going on. And I thought, wait a minute, everyone told me this was how you're supposed to do it. And I couldn't figure it out. I was trying to see if it was a colder winter, so maybe we used more natural gas. And after a few days, I found out that Holy Cross, which was mostly coal-powered electricity, had actually gotten more coal-intense in the last year or two. And so that was more important than anything else we had ever done. And so this was one of the major epiphanies of my life, which was to oh my, this isn't about me. It's not about my house. It's about the system. And in this case, the system is the utility. And so from that point, I worked with this group of people who know who they are. But Randy Udall and I were very involved in this. Again, Bob Schultz, others. And we did a grassroots community organizing, door-knocking digital campaign to start picking off seats. Another player in this was Adam Palmer from the Eagle Valley, who died a few years ago in an avalanche. But it was this it's just an interesting story that the point of the story isn't to say, do this with your utility. The point of the story is to say, how do you think in big systemic high leverage ways, not changing a light bulb, but changing a system?
Mm-hmm. What about pressuring our representatives? And we're out here in Western Colorado with Jeff Hurd. How's Jeff Hurd doing, in your estimation? And how do we reach that?
Well, he's a disaster. But you know, let me tell you a story about going to see Scott Tifton in Grand Junction. So one of the things I advocate is you have to show up at your elected officials' offices and you got to talk to them. So I went representing Aspen Skiing Company a number of years ago. This was Tipton, who was very conservative. And I said, I don't understand why you're not working more on climate change. There's all these impacts to Colorado. And there's all these opportunities, business opportunities, and clean energy. And he said, how many people this month you think came into my office and and asked me about climate change. And I said, none. And he said, yeah. And so then I thought, well, who am I to expect this guy to be working on something that, as far as he can tell, nobody cares about? And so from one perspective, that's an obvious miss by the movement, right? Like, we should be on this more. Now, it's disingenuous to think that Scott Tipton or Jeff Hurd is going to do anything on climate if we just talk to them more. But it is true that politicians respond to what the community cares about, and we haven't been very vocal about this. In CD3 and Jeff Hurd's seat, we have to win that seat back. This is a great opportunity to do it. I'm supporting Duane Romero. I think he's an amazing candidate and a very authentic guy. So to the extent we have a shot at taking CD3 back, this is it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another thing that's going on right now is gas prices are kind of through the roof. Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
The Iran war, to me personally, has been one of the most horrifying and depressing things I have seen in my life, including the civilian casualties and schoolgirls. It's nauseating and sickening. Plus, it's illegal. It's a violation of the Constitution. But let's look at what it's doing. Trump and crew were already in terrible, and they were going to lose badly in the midterms. But by invading Iran, which nobody wants them to do, they're basically putting the final nail in their coffin. This accelerates the transition away from Trumpism. Then the increase in gas prices supports an electric vehicle market and an electrification that Trump was doing everything he could to gut. So it's possible that out of the ruins, Phoenix-like, the clean energy movement is going to continue to thrive. And by the way, it's already thriving. As your listeners know, Bill McKibben has a new book out called Here Comes the Sun that says solar energy is exploding finally. In fact, last year, very recently actually, the total amount of clean energy in the world surpassed that of fossil energy.
Right, and it's gotten competitive and beyond competitive in price, which is a really huge hurdle to pass. But let's talk about Venezuela. One of the, there's a lot to talk about there, but one of the most shocking things was the way Trump was so upfront about the goals for Venezuela that this is not nation building, this is resource theft. We want their oil.
Yeah, I mean, that's its own, you know, kettle of fish that would take all day to discuss. But I don't think Venezuelan oil is going to help us that much. I mean, if you dig in on that, that country needs to rebuild all its infrastructure. It's very dense, thick oil. I'm not sure there's any there. I mean, I think the real problem with Venezuela is how are you, as a country, are you really doing that? Are you really coming in and taking out leaders? Just on that kind of broad region of the world. My daughter studied in Cuba last year for a semester at the University of Havana, and we visited her. And what's happening in Cuba now is a humanitarian crisis. It's starving children. It's keeping people who need insulin, preventing them from getting insulin. It's no light, no electricity. It's horrendous. And it's an authoritarian government, so there's no regime that's going to take over. And it's sickening and embarrassing. That's no kind of foreign policy, let alone energy policy.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a second here. We're ticking down on the time, but you do talk a little bit about nuclear energy in the book. Nuclear energy has kind of a bad reputation among environmentalists. We do have that problem of not really knowing what to do with what's left over. But, for years, associating with really thoughtful people in the energy world, nuclear energy has some really big pluses to it. Can you talk about nuclear energy?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a person who thinks that nuclear energy has big pluses. I think that the environmental community broadly thinks that we should keep existing nukes running as long as we can while we make this transition. But the reality of nuclear is that it's always been way, way, way more expensive than other forms of energy, like extremely more expensive. And you also have trouble permitting it in the United States, insuring it. No one wants to site it in their backyard, and you don't know what to do with the waste. Mm-hmm. So the resurgence of the nuclear industry is saying, well, our problem was always price, so our solution is going to make these things even smaller. Well, all that does is eliminate your economy of scale. So I think you can like the idea of nuclear, and you can see where it has some merit, but it's going to be very hard to pull off when you can produce new clean energy using solar at 1 kilowatt hour, sometimes with storage.
In Trump 2, the sequel, there's so many things that have happened. Has history gotten ahead of your book? Are there things that you would have added or changed or talked about if the book had come out a year later?
You know, that's a funny question, because when the book came out in November of 2024, so basically the beginning of 2025, Trump won, and I thought, I'm a dead man. You know, like, this is a disaster. But the book is about fighting hard battles and waking up in the morning and drinking two stiff cups of coffee and getting to work and doing that work with joy and humility, with community and family. So I honestly think it's the perfect message for this time, where we have hard fights, but that's what human beings do. We take impossible battles and we grind away. We don't win them. We keep going, and we build so that people behind us can build on our work and eventually win.
Nicely said. The title of the book is Terrible Beauty: Reckoning with Climate Complicity and Rediscovering Our Soul. And I guess that's the rediscovering our soul part of that message. And I should mention, too, that the book is partly articles that were published in other places and a big, broad discussion about how to make change. But it's also a personal story about your own children and your own family as well. It's partly memoir.
Yeah, people in the valley will recognize a lot of those stories. Some take place on Cataract Canyon. They'll notice people there. Yeah, and, you know, the book is about community and joy, and is Katie and Kay, and so is White River Books. And so if people are interested in the book, the local bookstore is the place to go find it, and that supports, actually not me, because writing books is not a profitable paradigm, but it supports that bookstore. So I'd urge people to, if they're interested, to go there.
White River Books, right down the street from us here. We've been talking to Auden Schendler, formerly the Environmental Affairs Director at the Aspen Skiing Company, and a brilliant mind. Auden, I did want to ask you before I let you go, what's the value of KDNK to our community? What's important about us?
I mean, at this time in history, we need community, we need democracy, we need art, we need new ideas to push us forward, we need ways of convening, and KDNK is all that. It's your friends, it's your brothers and sisters, it's fun, it's not cookie cutter, and so it's so worth supporting, and it's so worth being a DJ at public radio as well, which I have been throughout my life in various small towns that I've lived in.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today on Valley Voices. And get the book and keep up the good fight. Thanks, Auden.
Thank you. Thanks for what you're doing. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, it's Ophira Eisenberg. Every day, a reporter right here in your community is sad.